Mr. Campbell.
Morning, Your Honor. Morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Terry Campbell. I represent the defendants in this case, John Asufi and Global Distributors. Your Honors, the District Court's decision in this case is simply inconsistent both with the factual record that was before it and the applicable law. And this is particularly so in the context in which this case was decided, that is, on summary judgment. Of course, this Court reviews that decision de novo, and under the standards that are now axiomatic, it must view all the evidence of the non-moving party, in this case the defendants, my clients, must view that evidence in a light that is most favorable. It must draw all justifiable inferences in favor of the non-moving party, and the evidence of the non-moving party must be believed. In this case, the District Court did not follow that mandate, and I would respectfully urge this Court that reversal is required because of that. I want to briefly talk about the facts here, because they are obviously central to the decision that the District Court made on summary judgment.
Mr. Campbell, yes. With respect to the facts, working through these regulations and the like, it certainly seemed to me that your clients had, in fact, not taken a number of the steps. Just so, for example, I didn't see any evidence that they had on file the signature, electronic password, or other identification of the customer. If it's a new customer, you have to do that. Once you've got that in your files, you can update it annually. But I didn't see anything about that, and I think the evidence indicated one of the sales was a cash sale, and I didn't see any evidence that in advance of the sale, not after the fact with the shipping receipt, but in advance of the sale, your client had on file signature, driver's license, and other form of identification. I mean, there are a lot of these, maybe these strike you as picky requirements, but the statute as a whole establishes these because these can be, as of course unfortunately happened here, these can be substances that are dangerous and or misused.
Well, and I think what the statute requires, Your Honor, you're correct. It requires that you obtain a signature. And
before you sell, I mean, if you look at the regulation, I'm looking at what am I looking at? The regulations that govern this statute, 1310.07 and 21 CFR, and that's where it really spells out and becomes quite clear that before the shipment is made, the shipping entity, such as your client, needs to know who is getting this. And you need to have on file these things, and you should be able to present to the government, this is what we had before we ever entrusted it to whoever it was, Airborne Express or anybody.
Well, I suppose that's a matter of dispute, Your Honor, in terms of when the sale is actually made. The Airborne Express delivery system is that they don't turn over the package until they receive a signature.
But did you have in your file, again, Part D and Part E together, what cover either cash purchasers, individuals, or entities, and a new customer who is not an individual or cash customer, and then repeated customers. And it shows what you've got to have in your file. No driver's license, no other form of identification was shown here. Some signature on an Airborne Express waybill isn't enough. I mean, it's maybe a piece of the puzzle even to give you the benefit of the doubt, but it's nothing like what these regulations are calling for.
Well, I don't know that any of the sales were cash transactions. They were described in the district court as COD deliveries, but I don't believe any of them were cash. I think they were paid for by check.
Maybe so. One of them I thought might have been, but let's assume they weren't. That takes you over to E, where you have to have on file the person's signature, electronic password, or other identification. Then once the authorized purchasing agent has been established, the agent list may be updated annually rather than on each order. And again, on file doesn't say to me, you know, at the point of delivery.
Well, it doesn't say one way or the other, and I think that's the important part, because they did get a signature. The signature
It says on file, though. How can you have something on file when it isn't on file?
Well, we have the Airborne Express signature receipt that has that, and Airborne Express is acting as the agent of Global. The thing about these proof of identity requirements is that they don't specify the manner in which any of this information must be obtained. In fact, it leaves it very much to the discretion of the seller, of the regulated party.
But I'm not sure I read subpart E that way. It looks like it specifies how it wants you to ensure that identity.
And I will grant you, Your Honor, that this is not a perfect means to obtain the signature. I will grant you that. But it is sufficient to accomplish the goal of the statute. The statute's design is to get proof of identity. It says in 1310.07b, you can obtain proof of identity essentially by any means. You have to ensure, or the goal of the statute is simply to ensure that the person or entity to whom you're selling the controlled substance, in this case a common cold remedy, is a legitimate business. That goal was accomplished. In fact, these are legitimate businesses. But again,
this is a regulated industry. You could send it to Procter & Gamble, and you know they're a legitimate business. They're listed on the New York Stock Exchange and all the rest of it, but I don't think you had the right to send it even to Procter & Gamble without going through the formalities that this statute and its implementing regulations called for. And I certainly don't think printing off an Internet Yellow Pages thing after the fact does the job.
Well, but, Your Honor, there was an affidavit from Mr. Asufi that says that's how he checked these businesses' legitimacy.
But it's not on file. It wasn't.
It doesn't say, in 1310.07b, it doesn't say you must maintain that on file. What it says is you have to have proof of identity. And what we had is Mr. Asufi identifying the company in the invoices accurately, had the address accurately, had the contact name accurately, had the contact phone number accurately, had the amounts of sold product accurately, had the delivery date accurately in his invoices. He had the Airborne Express receipts that have the name of the person, the authorized agent, who ordered it and received it. He had all of the information to identify the customers. And the best proof that the purpose of the statute was met is that Mr. Asufi turns over these records on day one when the agents come out there. It took the agents, if you look at the DEA reports that are attached as exhibits to the summary judgment briefs, it took the DEA less than half a day to track down who had diverted this product. They went to those addresses. They were actual businesses. The people whose names were listed as the authorized agents worked at those businesses. They found those people within hours. Mr. Asufi's record keeping was clearly sufficient to accomplish the goal, which is to make sure that the DEA, the government, has the ability to track these sales. He sold to legitimate businesses.
But your argument essentially is that these regulatory requirements don't really need to be complied with, that something along the lines of substantial compliance is enough. And I don't see that either in the regulations or in any of the case law.
No, Your Honor, that's not my argument. My argument is that the facts, given or viewed in their best light for the defense, show compliance with these regulations.
That's not what Mr. Asufi argued, though, below, was it?
No, in fact, it is, Your Honor. In the motion that I filed after we came into the case, which was after summary judgment had been granted, I think the way I described it was that he had perhaps inartfully argued this. But if you look back at the record...
this is the problem of being a replacement lawyer, I think.
Yeah, but if you look back at the record, Your Honor, and I went through this last night, if you look back at the original motion for summary judgment that Mr. Asufi filed, and that's document 46, he said things like that the product was delivered to the designated businesses, that Airborne Express was instructed to not deliver the product unless it was signed for by an authorized representative. He argued that Global verified the identity of the stores, quote, by doing an Internet search of the company name. He argued that was, quote, verified by Airborne Express records of delivery. That's on pages 2 and 3 of the summary judgment memorandum. It goes on page 5 to say that there was indeed more than sufficient identification to comply with the statutory requirements. He says, before sending the product, Global obtained, quote, all the delivery information, name, address, contact person, etc., and that Airborne acted as an agent for Global. All of this is in the original summary judgment motion. As far as the evidence to support those statements, those are attached either to the memo in support of the summary judgment brief of the defendants, which was the first thing that was filed, There are the Airborne Express documents. There is the Asufi affidavit, which talks about what he did in order to ensure compliance. There are examples of the Internet checks. There are the global invoices, which contain, as I said, the name, address, customer name, contact information, authorized agent. There is the deposition of Agent Galvin, in which he expressly said, and if you look at his affidavit that was submitted on behalf of the government, he lists out, here's what we had from the global invoices. We had the name of the person. We had the contact address. We had the business name. We had the phone number. It was very easy for the government to accomplish the central goal of this statute, which is to track these shipments so that if they are diverted, and let's remember, there's no argument here that Mr. Asufi or Global had any role or knowledge about the diversion of this product after it was sold to what everyone admits was a legitimate business. Everyone admits that. So all of this evidence was in the record at the first instance when the summary judgment briefs were put before the district court. The same type of arguments you'll find in what's attached to document 51, which was prior counsel's motion to reconsider. This is the response to the government's Rule 56 statement of facts. And again, he goes through and argues that sufficient information was collected. I'll give you just one example. There's a quote in there in response to the government's fact number 23 that says, without more, the invoices and the carrier confirmations, which are part of the record herein, demonstrate that more than sufficient proof of identity was obtained by Global. So this is not a new argument. It is an argument that was made with the very first summary judgment briefs. I want to touch on, before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You're into your rebuttal.
Okay. The last issue is the amount of the fine. And given the facts and the circumstances here, the fact that this is a small business that has no history of any improper conduct, the fact that we're talking about 8 sales out of literally thousands of sales that company makes, the fact that he had no involvement in the diversion of the product, all counsel strongly against the imposition of the district court of the maximum fine allowable. I will talk on rebuttal about the cases we focused on in our reply, Advanced Pharmaceutical, where the company, after being confronted by the DEA, continued to make sales of pseudoephedrine to customers they knew were diverting it. The court there said they made $2 million in profits. They ought to be a fine of $2 million. Here, Mr. Asufi and Global made approximately $1,500, $1,500 to $2,000 in profits, and they were fined $200,000. It is, under any standard, an inappropriate fine.
Thanks. Mr. Donatelli.
May it please the Court.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. What the district court did was say, essentially, under any of the stories you're telling, and there were many going forth, is none of them are exculpatory for you.
Let me just start with the penalty here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which we ended with. $1,000 to $1,500 was the total profit here. $11,000 worth of product that was sold. So you got a very small profit. Sales to 4 different businesses in a very short period of time by a company with no history, apparently, of violating the law. And it seems to me that a maximum penalty ought to be reserved for the most egregious of cases, and maybe a maximum penalty on one of these counts, but to stack 8 consecutive maximum penalties together here, it seems to be a little excessive to me, but maybe you can tell me where I'm wrong.
And, of course, even if it seems excessive to somebody, this issue has the abuse of discretion standard applied to it.
I understand.
And what the district court judge said is that a smaller penalty she felt the maximum was warranted because of the culpability exhibited by Mr. Asufi. And the way she explained his culpability was, it was clear, the district court judge was not happy. She called it, he has been less than upfront with the court. And then she talked about why that was true. And, of course, the bad faith on the part of the distributor is a part of the test, one of the factors you assess in assessing the damages.
But, Mr. Donatelli, this kind of relates a little bit to what Judge Evans was saying, and I was disturbed reading through both what the district court had to say and then reading through your brief at the lack of say, a matchup, you know, exactly which requirements of which regulations did Mr. Asufi and Global fail to meet? Because as Mr. Campbell argues, they did a lot. They had a lot of information. It was certainly readily retrievable in the files. And it would have been extremely helpful for the district court to say, you didn't do X, you didn't do Y, you didn't do Z. And we keep getting these kind of overall statements. I don't want to say global statements, but overall statements about, you know, well, this wasn't enough somehow. And I am having trouble because, and the reason that it would be very useful to me to see at a much more precise level than anyone's furnished so far relates in part to the amount of the fine. Are these just really niggly little requirements that don't deserve such an enormous fine, at least relative to the profits made? Or are these really core central requirements and, you know, a defiant attitude of some type that require this degree of deterrence? I mean, we just don't have it pinned down well.
When the case was filed, Judge, the status, what the government could see from its point of view was that Mr. Asufi had told the DEA investigator at the time he was doing his review of the records that he pleaded ignorance. He didn't know about these requirements and didn't follow them. So the case actually went on a complaint and into adjudication as he admitted he did know the stuff.
But you had the records and you have the regulations and you filed for summary judgment. And Mr. Campbell points to a number of things that Mr. Asufi said in his response. You certainly had the identity of the purchasing agent. You had where that person could be called. You yourself were looking at the invoices, right? That was one of your pieces of evidence.
Well, what we had was we knew from the invoices. That was our evidence.
Yeah, you had the invoices, which had a lot of information
right,
on them.
It had that Global made a sale on such and such date to that the business entity. It didn't have the authorized agent on there.
Okay, so that's the first thing I'm trying to glean out of you. I mean, your mm-hmm. brief could have said, all right, authorized purchasing agent, when do you need to know, where in the regulations does it say you have to have that piece of information before the sale is made rather than after? What's the language you're relying on? And how serious a defalcation was this that it's on the Airborne Express waybill?
And the first that we're really hearing to a great extent that Mr. Asufi complied with the authorized agent one is really on appeal. In the district court where it went...
But this is de novo review, of course.
Right.
If there's some disputed issue of fact about this, would we need to remand?
Absolutely not. But I'm explaining why...
Well, I know you don't want us to, but if there's a disputed issue of fact, we would have to.
There isn't one. But I'm explaining why this wasn't highlighted in the district court. It became such a mess because of... It was one of the stories where Mr. Asufi and Global threw out a bunch of things. I did this, we did this, the whole bit, and none of it matched, and it was frustrating to the district court and to the government. It's because his main part of the story was he third-partied in his independent contractor, who, in the first version of events, was actually an employee. But in the second version of events, he became an independent contractor, and the thrust of his argument was he was supposed to do it. I was duped by him. He was handling the whole thing. And in fact,
Mr. Ali, we're
yes,
talking about?
Yes, Mr. Yeah. Ali. And Mr. Asufi says, what I did is I sold it to Ali. Well, that's not what the records show. But I sold it to him, and then he sold it to them. But just to do him a favor for business, I sent it directly to the second seller, you know, to the second buyer, rather, and not to him. And I stored it in my warehouse, and I did it by Airborne Express. None of the story made sense. That'd be a very silly way to do business. So we were still never focusing on any of these individual things. It appeared none of it worked. And so what the district court said is, listen, you're making excuses. First you plead ignorance, and then when that doesn't work, then you say, no, he did it. It's his fault. And what she found is that whatever story you're telling, the act is kind of simple. You're the guy who's...
Well, let me talk about that. Yeah. I understand there were a lot of different stories here, and that's part of the problem why this is so gummed up, but if I have a convenience store in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and customers that ask for release a common cold medication, and I think, I ought to start stocking that in my store. Now, I find out that of all the places, Global is one of them that sells this stuff. So I call Global, and I want to order a bunch of these things. Now, you walk me through what kind of records Global has to keep in that type of a situation.
That Global has to keep to distribute?
Sure. Yeah. Now, I call, and I say, do you distribute this stuff? Yes, they do. I'd like to order 50 boxes or whatever. Now, what do they have to do?
We know that at the time the order is placed, and we're back into the CFR 1370.07, and it's the ones Judge Wood really discussed. We know at the time that order is placed, he has to have the other party present documents to verify their identity or their registration status, if they have it. We know that...
Well, could that be done with just... I send you a fax with on a letterhead of my convenience store?
It might be. The statute and the CFR don't say that exactly, but I think if you're a good businessman, you want some piece of paper.
Well, the...
Otherwise, how is it ever going to be investigated if you don't document it?
The defendant's brief at pages 4 and 6 shows what information was on the invoices.
Defendant's brief 4 and 6? All right.
Yeah. Can you tell me what more information really ought to have been there than what is on page 4 to 6? You know, whether that's true or not, what's on 4 to 6, but...
And I'm sorry, your question again is on page 46?
Yeah. They have the eight different sales here. July 7th, the last one, 99, to the Texaco Mart in Fort Myers, Florida, the name of the contact person, a phone number.
Right.
Address.
That does not constitute, to me, documents that verify the identity or the registration status of the registrant. It does not contain...
What does that mean, the registration status of the registrant?
I think also if they're licensed by DEA. That's what if they're registered to themselves to handle this product.
Texaco Mart here would have to have a license from the DEA to sell this over-the-counter cold medicine?
You mean like Walgreens?
Yeah. Well, no.
We know it's all behind glass.
Well, you mean some purchasers would have a registration status.
It could.
If it were Walgreens ordering it from Global, and others like Texaco Mart would say, we don't have a DEA number, and they would then furnish other identification material?
That's it. They could have a registration status or not, according to
the CFR.
Well,
let's say they don't have a registration status. I don't know that.
Then they present documents which verify their identity. Whether that's vague or not, I think what you do is you do your proof of who you are.
But you agree that this there's a Texaco Mart on Fowler Street in Fort Myers,
there
Florida,
appears to
with
be
a phone number. And
there appears to be, but it also appears that we don't know who the representative is. We know who signed the Airborne Express. I don't know that Airborne Express, who's somehow the agent for this firm. God knows if these trucking companies become everybody's agent. But who they got to sign it, we don't know. And, in fact, what we do know, what we found out later, is that when we interviewed each of these legitimate businesses that they appear legitimate, they said, that wasn't us. We didn't get that. It was there was a scheme of a guy involved with several of these, and it appeared that it was diverted.
I understand that, and I understand that there's no evidence that Global was in cahoots with anybody here. Right. Somebody was getting this stuff and diverting it to make meth. But I'm just wondering, when looking at this, what more information a little convenience store in Sheboygan, Wisconsin needs to provide to avoid, for Global to avoid violating this law?
I think you keep a file of the proof of identity, in other words, whatever they send you. Let's say it's the facts you described. Then I think you also keep a record B, which is whether you're checking the telephone directory, the credit bureau. I think you need a record of that to verify that was done. I think the one in C, you need to show that you verified the claimed agency status of the representative. In other words, at least put in there.
Saying, though, you think that these things should happen. And as I understand Mr. Campbell's argument, it's that 1310 doesn't say in so many words, before anything is shipped, the regulated person, in this instance Global, must have on file the following 10 items, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, you know. And if it's unclear, then to nail them, first of all, have they even violated it? But secondly, if it's unclear and it's a technical violation, to nail them for the full $200,000 is the question.
Okay, two things. The first is, the only timeline I've seen in the statute is it says at the time the order is placed. And, of course, that makes sense. If you're doing it later, it's too late. It's already distributed, or it's at the time of the distribution. So you've got to do this call.
What section of the statute says at the time the order is placed?
That's the CFR 1310.07A. Okay. That's where you have to have the other party present documents to verify at the time the order is placed. Secondly, don't forget, these are in the provisions for record keeping. This is all within the provisions for record keeping under the statute. If you just say you did it, that's not record keeping, and how would the DEA ever do its job of going and making sure there's compliance with the statute if there's not records of it? So I think you need the records. In terms of the penalty, all I can say is, the district court judge found him very culpable because she thought these were deliberate violations because he knew better. He got his license. He was instructed by DEA as to how to do this, and he didn't do it. And when confronted with it, he pled ignorance. And she said, I actually think that was the more believable story. But then, when that didn't work, he started changing his story. And she thought that exhibited bad faith on his part. There was also evidence that was unrebutted when it was presented to the judge when she was determining the penalty that this Mr. Sufi had used various of his name and his Social Security number.
Were those mistakes? Are one number off or something? Or was there something?
There's a list of them. And they're in the summary judgment motion, and sometimes they'd have one number off, and then other times his name would be it'd have a different middle initial, or there'd be a little variant there, and the same with his the Social Security. It would be close.
Those were out of a large number.
There were, I'd say, I think we found a good, I'm guessing now because I forget it's not in my brief, about a dozen different Social Security numbers, and I think many more different names.
How many hundreds, were correct, I guess. Maybe that's one way of putting it. Was this half of them or one-tenth of them?
I don't know. What we did is when we did our search on him, we were coming up with all sorts of variants on his name and Social Security number that were matching. And we argued that they were too numerous to just be a glitch here or there.
Did this whole thing come to pass because a person, you know, the lab was discovered and then they backed into finding where the meth came from, where the ingredients came from? Is that how this all got going?
I think it was a part of a bigger investigation.
But it seemed logical that they'd trace back where it came from and then go through all these records and then go back to Global, right?
It may be. That's not in the record. I don't know that. I don't know the criminal end of it, as how the criminal investigation started and whom all was involved. I think this grew out of one of those, though.
But other than those discrepancies in the letters and stuff, I assume Global has lots of customers. And that may be a wrong assumption.
We were able to show a substantial ability to pay. We were able to show $2 million.
In Florida, all these are having to be down in Florida. Is that unusual for a Chicago operation to have clients way down in Florida for what I think is a national distribution? I never heard a release, but that doesn't mean
I don't know if that's unusual for Global. The records I saw, it was unusual. It was not usual for Global. Wait, I don't know if it's unusual for companies to deal with Florida, but I think for Global it was.
Well, what percentage of Global's business was distributing products that contained a controlled substance? I thought most of the stuff they did was sell bathroom.
I think it said like 20. That's in the brief, too, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was like 25% of its business or something had to do with regulated products, I think. But I do put that in my brief. I just would have to look for it now.
Okay.
Thanks, Judge. Yeah. But we ask this court to affirm.
All right. Mr. Campbell, you've got a couple minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to touch on, obviously, a few of the things that Mr. Donatelli argued, which I think are flawed. We'll start with one of the last things that you talked about, and that is the evidence that was presented to the district court with respect to what damages ought to be imposed. And the government has focused on the fact that there were, as they call it, many variants of his name and Social Security number. Mr. Asufi's name is Nashwan Asufi. When he came to America, he began using the name John. If you look at the list, and it's in document 50 on the district court docket, it's page 5 of the government's brief on damages, they list out, and the name variants that they're talking about are Nashwan Asufi, Nashwan with a middle initial Y Asufi, Nashwan with a middle initial I Asufi, John Asufi, John Y Asufi, John I Asufi. Mr. Asufi speaks with a significant accent. They don't tell you where these names are from. They don't tell you what database they came from. They don't tell you for what purpose, if any, these were used. It seems to me that it is much more likely that those variants in the names, if you can call them variants at all, when you talk about John with a middle initial or John without a middle initial, if they are variants at all, they are the result of data processing errors, if anything. But there was no evidence to tell you what these were, where they were from, what they were for. Nothing. So to rely on that, I think, is entirely misguided. They say that the district court made a determination that the maximum fine was appropriate in part because the district court came to the conclusion that Mr. Asufi was not being straight with the district court. Well, Mr. Asufi never testified in this case. The government never deposed him. The only person who was ever deposed in this case was the agent. And you'll see in one of the judge's opinions in the district court, she refers to it as the defendant's deposition. It was not. It was the agent's deposition. One deposition taken. Asufi's only presentation before the district court was in the affidavit of the agent in which he characterized what Asufi had purportedly said to him when he made the first visit, and what is in Mr. Asufi's affidavit where he lays out, here's what we did, here's the information that was collected. The government also focuses on this issue about whether Mr. Ali was an independent contractor or an employee. We pointed out to the court in our reply brief, I believe, that there was no discrepancy there, that in the agent's report, which is attached to our filing, which is docket number 100 before the district court, we attach the DEA report where they say he was an independent contractor, both at the first interview and later on in Mr. Asufi's affidavit. I would lastly say that the fact that the district court and the government were frustrated, as Mr. Donatelli said, is not a basis, first, to find summary judgment against this man, this small business owner, who has done the right thing, who has done the right thing in selling this product, and secondly, to impose the maximum allowable fine when he has presented evidence, and the evidence is clearly laid out in that document, in the exhibits attached to document 100 before the district court about what he did and his business practices in Chicago. I would ask the court to reverse and remand this case. I believe that summary judgment is appropriate in favor of the defendants, but at a minimum, we have a factual dispute that must be resolved by the fact finder.
Okay, thanks. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.